Now, our study this morning, if you want to follow along, is in Luke chapter 20. We're picking up in the middle of the chapter where we left off. So how cold did it get last night? What's the worst you had at your place? Eight below? Anybody do better than eight below? No? It was like six or so at mine, I think. It was four below when I got in the car to come here this morning, so it hasn't warmed up a whole lot. Car did not want to run. Pretty light this morning, which means we're not alone. I know Bob was over my place yesterday borrowing some tubing cutters because he had some broken pipes that he was working on. And why do we live in this place? Have we figured that out yet? Somebody, I don't get on Facebook a whole lot, but I was on there for something yesterday or the day before, and there was a picture of a front door with this huge snake crawling up it. And it said, "This is why I live where it's so cold my face hurts," because it's none of those things. All right. Luke chapter 20. Well, you remember the scene. We've had the triumphal entry. We've had Jesus come in on the donkey. The people acknowledge him as the Messiah. The first time he's openly let that happen, the religious leaders say, "Hey, you got to tell him to knock that off. That's blasphemy. Tell him to stop." And he said, "Look, this is the time. If they didn't say it, the rocks would cry out." And then his next move in the midst of that celebration and that rejoicing is he starts weeping over the city because they're rejecting him. And he knows what's going to happen. A week from now or less, he's going to be hanging on the cross. He knows that's happening. And then he comes in and he cleans out the temple. He kicks out the people who are ripping people off in the name of religion. Second time he's done that, which, of course, upsets the high priest and his cronies because they're the ones who are running the booths and the tables. And so they come up to him, you remember, and they say, "By what authority are you doing this? Who gives you the right to come in here and do it?" And he says, and again, you have to remember the scene. There are thousands and tens of thousands of people swarming around him. It's packed. The tensions are high. There's Roman soldiers there, extra Roman soldiers to help keep the peace. All the Jews are there. The religious leaders are there. And they're like, "Who do you think you are?" And he said, "Well, let me ask you a question. You want to ask about authority? John the Baptist. Was his message from God or was it not?" And he's got them on the spot because if they say, they reason among themselves, they call a little huddle, and they say, "Well, if we say that John was a prophet," which everybody thinks, the people think he was a prophet, "if we say he was a prophet," he'll say, "Well, why didn't you listen to him then? Because he said to repent, and he was the one who pointed to me and said, 'I'm the Lamb of God, so why don't you listen to him?' So we clearly can't say that. But on the other hand, if we say that it was of men, that he really wasn't a prophet, the people are going to flip their lid, and they're going to lose it, and they're going to, you know, we'll lose any authority we have, so we obviously can't say that. What do we say?" So they tell him, "Well, we can't say." They don't even say, "We don't know." They say, "We can't say." Like, very Clinton-esque, you know, depends on what the meaning of the word is. "We can't say." And he says, "Well, then, if you can't say, I'm not going to tell you by what authority I do this." And the truth is, if you're not accepting John's authority, you're never going to accept mine because it comes from the same place. And then he tells that parable about the vineyard and referring back to Isaiah, the person who had planted a vineyard and talking about the Lord. And remember, Israel was his vineyard, it says at the end of it, and he'd hedged it and protected it, and he planted grapes, and then all he got back was wild grapes. He was looking for a delicious, sweet harvest, which was justice and mercy and those things. And instead, he had people ripping off people in the name of religion. He had people rejecting the one who owned the vineyard, God, And then he asks him, you know, "Well, what's going to happen? What's he going to do?" He sends emissaries and they kill them. They beat them up. He sends his son. They kill his son. He says, "Well, what's the Lord of the vineyard going to do? He's going to wipe them out." And they all say, "God forbid." And so we pick up at the end of that. And he talks about himself being the chief cornerstone. Anybody who falls on it will be broken, but whoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. And then it says, verse 19, "The chief priests and the scribes the same hour sought to lay hands on him. And they feared the people, for they perceived that he had spoken this parable against them." They feared the people. They were people pleasers. I hate being a people pleaser. I am. There's a part of me that wants everybody to like me. There's a part of me that will... There's, it's funny, certain situations come up, and there's two ways you can react to it. You can say, as a Christian, how should I react to this situation, or what should I do in this situation, which is the right way. Or you can say, what will people think of me because I've said I'm a Christian if they see me act or do something in a certain way? And a lot of times that's much worse, and I hate that that's there. Well, these guys are definitely there. They are all about appearance, and we'll get into that a little more, probably not this week, but all about outward show. And they fear the people. So they decided, well, he just threw us in front of the people, and he gave us an either-or situation. Was John, was he sent from God or was he not? And we were stuck in a place where we couldn't answer, and the people loved it because it shut us up. We should return the favor. Let's do the same thing to him. And it says in verse 20, they watched him, and they sent forth spies which should feign themselves just men. In other words, they will pretend to be religious, righteous men, that they might take hold of his words, that they might deliver him under the power and authority of the governor. They're going to try to trip him up in his words. Now, remember, this is leading up to the Passover, where they're going to sacrifice a lamb that has to be without spot, without blemish, all of that. So at the same time, the priests are busy inspecting hundreds and thousands of lambs to be used during the Passover. Jesus is there in the religious leaders being inspected in the same way. He's going to be the Lamb of God. And so they decide to send some people to him that are faking it. They are pretending to be righteous, religious. They're framing this question as a religious question, and they're framing it like an honest question. It's not an honest question, but they're framing it that way. They're giving the appearance because they don't want him to just back out and say, well, I said I wouldn't tell you what. They want to stick it to him, so they send some people that are faking it. And you can tell they're faking it by the way they try to butter him up before they ask. Verse 21, they ask him, saying, Master, we know that you say and teach rightly, and neither accept you the person of any, but you teach the way of God truly. You know, when your kids come to you and they start a conversation with, Mom, have I ever told you how much I love you? You're just the best, Mom. What do you want? Okay? Because you know that's where it's going. They're layering on the butter. It takes a few years to really get good at that and to do it subtly. So when they're real young, they're real obvious. But this is people trying to do it to God. Anytime you're trying to trap God in his words and trip him up or set up a ridiculous question to try to get him to contradict himself, it's just not going to happen. So they say that, which is true. It is true. He does teach rightly. He doesn't accept the person of anyone. Whereas they fear people and they're man pleasers, that's not him. He has no problem offending his followers. He has no problem offending the religious leaders or even, you know, the government. He doesn't accept the person of any, and he teaches the way of God truly. So here's your question. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not? Is it lawful for us to pay taxes? Tribute to Caesar, specifically they're talking about the denarius, kind of the poll tax. It's basically, there are a number of taxes they paid. They paid sales tax. They paid property tax. They paid tariffs and traveling certain places. But this was the tax that you paid for the right of being alive. Everybody who was alive in the Roman kingdom every year had to pay a denarius or a couple. It wasn't an outrageous as far as the volume of tax compared to everything else they paid. It wasn't a huge amount of money. But it was still a tax that every person had to pay to Rome. And see, for the Jewish leaders, at this point, Rome as the conquering entity, and I forget exactly when it happened, it was somewhere probably 10, 15 years prior to this, they had lost, Rome took away, because of some of their foolishness and rebellion, the ability for the Jews to exercise the death penalty. That was always seen going all the way back to Genesis when after the flood, God said, whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. That the right of government to use the death penalty to enforce the law. And that was seen as the sign of authority. And even though down through the ages at various times the Jews had been subjugated, you know, they went to Babylon for a while, they still retained that within their culture. about 10, 15 years before this, Rome took it away. You remember when they go to Pilate in a few days to have Jesus crucified, he says, why are you bringing this to me? And they said, because we don't have the right to put anybody to death. So Rome had clearly established the fact that they were in charge. Part of any government's establishing their right to be in charge is the minting of currency. Every time a new Caesar came in, he'd make his own coins. The Roman Senate could do copper coins. Only Caesar could mint silver or gold coins. Our government, you know, we have the Federal Reserve and we print our money and we mint our coins. I think they're still metal, aren't they? The pennies certainly aren't. You ever drop a penny? Like anything before was at the 80s or whatever, you drop a penny and it rings. After that, it just sounds like, I don't know, plastic poker chips. It just kind of clicks. It's there's no value to them. Used to be the money was silver, and then they started sandwiching some silver between some junk, and now it's all junk and no sandwich. It's like the Oreos these days. They're not like they used to be. Caesar had minted coins. And so they want to know, is it right for us to pay tribute to Caesar? Should we pay our taxes? And see, this is a valid question, right? It's tax season. We'll be paying taxes soon. If you're getting a return, if you're getting a refund, you've probably already filed. If you're paying, April 14th or 15th will be the day when yours gets postmarked, like me. Is it okay to submit to the government? Well, he recognizes what they're doing because it says he perceived their craftiness and he said, why are you tempting me? Here was the deal. On one hand, the Jews hated Rome. Remember, this holiday was the equivalent of their Independence Day. And so every year celebrating it would be, you know, the whole charged atmosphere of, is this going to be the year the Messiah comes and we rebel and we finally take back our right to be sovereign and all of that. By paying that tax to Caesar, you are, in effect, acknowledging his right to have authority over you. And so a whole side of Judaism, the religious side, says, we'll have no government over us. We only submit to God. That's right. We were not going to pay that tax. We're not even going to use his filthy money. That's one side of Judaism. The other side was Rome. You know, the other side was Rome. And if you didn't do what they said, you'd be put to death. We'll let you do your holidays. We'll let you do your little religious thingies, but you don't rebel and you pay your taxes and we'll be fine. I mean, it's interesting when you go through the Dave Ramsey program, you know, it's very much about not using credit and getting yourself in a huge hole in debt. But when it comes to how you deal with paying your taxes, he is a big fan of you pay your taxes because they're not like other creditors. The government wants their pound of flesh. They're going to get their pound of flesh. They can do things to you that nobody else can do, so you pay your taxes, right? But that's a question even in the church. We rebel, especially depending on who's president. If it's somebody we like, we're not as mad about it. If it's somebody we don't like, then we don't want to pay taxes because they're all crooks and they're, you know, using our money on ungodly things. He's like, why are you tempting me? He perceived their craftiness. Interesting, Matthew and Mark also give an account of this. In Matthew, it says Jesus perceived their wickedness. And in Mark, it says, but he knowing their hypocrisy. This question was crafty, it was wicked, and it was hypocritical. And the reason why it's hypocritical is this. He says, show me a penny, show me the coin, the denarius. Whose image and screw prescription on it? And they answered, it was Caesar's. Now, one of them has it, pulls it right out of his pocket. Tiberius had minted coins. At this point, this would be the Tiberius denarius that was in effect. You can go to Wikipedia and see a picture of one if you want. On the front of it was his head. And inscripted around it in Latin, which I can't give you the Latin because I don't speak Latin. But the equivalent was Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus, right? Divinity means what? God, right? So on the front of this coin, he is claiming to be the son of the god Augustus. He's claiming to be the son of God. On the back of it is a picture of him sitting on a chair, and it says Pontiff Maxim. highest priest. So on one side of this coin that they're using is him claiming to be the Son of God. On the back side is him claiming to be the high priest, which is why the Jews flipped out and didn't want to use that money. But here he says, the person who's asking the question, who's trying to trap him, because if he says, yeah, you should pay taxes, they figure the people who hate paying taxes are all going to reject him. If he says, no, don't pay taxes, all they have to do is tell out to Rome, he's arrested, put to death, case closed. They've got him on the horns of a dilemma. Should we not? Yes or no? You have to pick one or the other. Well, he perceives the hypocrisy. He says, well, show me a coin, and they dig it out. The fact that you're holding the coin, you already have your answer. Because if you're using the money, you're subject to their rules and their authority, right? They have a coin. He doesn't, interesting, but they do. And he says, well, whose picture's on this? Caesar's. And whose name is written around the outside of that? Whose imprint? Whose likeness is this? Oh, it's Caesar's. So he says to them, brilliantly, render therefore to Caesar the things which be Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's. The word render there, it literally means give what is due or give what you owe. Give what is owed to Caesar, and give what is owed to God. The money was Caesar's. If Caesar wants some of his money, give him his money. The question is what is owed to God? You know, he says, whose picture is that? Whose image is that? And he said, well, it's Caesar's. The money's made in Caesar's image. He minted it himself. He made it with his own picture on it. Well, it's his, then it belongs to him. The question is, whose image are we made in? You remember what it said back in Genesis chapter 1? God says, let's make man in our image, after our likeness. God created man in his own image, and the image and likeness of God created he him, male and female created he them. We're made in God's image and likeness, which means the money is made in Caesar's image. Caesar can have the money. You, which God is more interested in you than your money, always. Even the Old Testament. Oh, the Old Testament's all about the tithe. Well, it was a part of the Jews' thing, the tithing. But even with the tithing, what was a tithe? It was a tenth. You give a tenth. But as far as your time, it was one day a week was the Sabbath, so he only asked for a tenth of their produce and their whatever, but he asked for a seventh of their time. God's always more interested in you than in what you have, because you don't have anything that he didn't already give you. Anything you've earned, you earned with the strength and the breath and the brain that he gave you. So it's all his. Give what's owed. You know, we're in an election season, so taxes will be mentioned a lot. A lot, a lot. Anybody like paying taxes? Is there anybody here who really enjoys paying taxes? To be honest with you, there was a bill that I paid recently, and because of some events of just a couple days ago, I was happy to pay that tax bill. I live on West Broadway, like just down the street here, before the light. You guys who live in town, did you see the water main that broke the other day right in front of the bank there on the corner? And so partway through the day, because that was just running and running and running and running, the pipes get low and then all the silt and stuff on the bottom gets stirred up, and then pretty soon the water coming out of my tap is like all cloudy and brown. And then late at night, they shut it off because they had to finish working on it. So overnight, we lost water. Just take for granted how nice it is to turn on the tap and have a drink of water. There's something nice about backing away from the toilet and seeing stuff just disappear automatically without any. It takes, 3 to 5 gallons of water to flush a toilet, you know? You have to haul that from a brook somewhere, or if you have to, and then they put an announcement on the town website, I don't know if you saw it, but people on West Broadway said needed to boil your water until further notice in order to drink it. Finally, thankfully, that evening, I found something on, not on the town website, but on another site that said, if you live between the grocery store and the electric company down there, that's where you had to boil it. Everybody else didn't have to, and thankfully, I was outside of that, so I could have stopped. But how annoying. You know, I'm glad to pay that money. I'm glad, last night, driving on the road, snowing, I'm glad to drive on a road that's plowed. I don't begrudge those people who are out plowing our road. I'm happy that we have a standing military. I appreciate my nephew who used to guard the border, and now apparently he doesn't work there anymore, and it doesn't seem like anybody else does either. They're just coming across. But I appreciate people who do that. I appreciate the police. I appreciate the Food and Drug Administration. I like knowing that the food that I get is at least somebody is looking at it and making sure they're not packing poison into the box. Those are all valid uses of taxes. We should be glad to pay that. How many of you guys cheat on your taxes? There is an honest man in here. Okay, let me rephrase that question. How many people know what the use tax is? Use tax on the Maine state tax return. You know, if you buy something in the state of Maine and it's not certain food items, you pay what? Sales tax, 5.5%, right? How many of you guys ever buy anything from Amazon? Right? You buy something from Amazon, you don't pay sales tax because Amazon doesn't have a presence, right? Or you buy anything mail order, you buy it on eBay, you buy it anywhere else. Do you know the use tax, if you read the description, the state of Maine says you're supposed to pay tax on anything you buy, sales tax. If you buy something out of state from a place that doesn't collect tax, like Amazon, if they don't collect sales tax for their municipality, or if that's different and less than what we pay in sales tax, you're supposed to voluntarily pay that on your taxes every year. You're supposed to write that amount in. You're supposed to keep track of everything you buy that you don't pay sales tax. Let me ask you again. How many of you guys cheat on your taxes? Romans says this, Romans chapter 13. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Think about that for just a minute. In fact, let me read this whole passage. Whoever therefore resists the power, resists the ordinance of God. And they that resist receive to themselves condemnation. For the rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Will you not be afraid of the power? Do which is good, and you'll have the praise of the same. He is the minister of God to thee for good. And if you do that which is evil, be afraid, because he doesn't bear the sword in vain. He is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that does evil. Therefore, you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for your conscience' sake. For this cause, pay you tribute also, pay taxes, because they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to who custom, fear to fear, honor to whom honor is due. Pay it. Because, look, we're in this political season, and I hate this. I hate the politics now. I really do. It grieves me, to be honest with you, and I'm not on Facebook a whole lot, mainly for this reason. Thank the Lord you can actually shut off certain people's feed. You know, you don't have to defriend them. You just don't have to listen to them. And look, we all have friends like that. We're acquaintances. I know you. We went to school together. I cannot stand your politics, or I cannot stand your religious views, or I cannot stand the continual fear-based stuff that you're posting, so I can just say, shh. And not listen, because so many people post stuff over and over again. Look, whether you like the current inhabitant of the White House or not, he is ordained, he is God's minister to you. Whether we get Hillary or Bernie or Donald or Ted or Mario or who knows who this next time, he will be or she will be ordained of God. Caesar was ordained of God. He was there. He was God's hand right now. Now, he wouldn't have been there. The Jews were mad that he was there. The reason why he was there is because they didn't listen to what God had said all the way back. Was it Deuteronomy 23, you know, the head of the tail? If you follow me, if you serve me, you won't. Other nations will serve you. But if you turn from me, they will come in and they will conquer you, and you'll have people speaking a language you don't understand and all this stuff. They have the leaders they deserved. We have the leaders we deserve. And we're supposed to pay tax. It doesn't mean we have to like them. And we have to realize, too, Peter said something similar. Both Paul and Peter, who said, pay your taxes, follow the government, were both put to death, had their heads chopped off, because they didn't. Because at some point, the government said, you need to stop talking about Jesus. And that's where they said, I'm sorry, but we can't do that. But all the other stuff, if they want your money, even if it's gross tax rates, give them your money. It's theirs anyways. And the truth is, it's not worth that much anymore. Well, they couldn't take hold of his words before the people. And they marveled at his answer, and they held their peace. So the next group came along. The Pharisees, you know, for many of us, were probably similar to many of us in that they were very conservative. They were very, as far as the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures went, they were literalist. They believed it was all true. In fact, they also had extra stuff. They believed in the traditions, in the man's opinion that was written after the fact, and they placed that on a real high level. That was where they blew it, and they became, you know, legalists. But they were certainly what you'd probably consider fundamentalists as far as Judaism went. The next group that comes is the Sadducees. It says, "Then came to him certain of the Sadducees, which deny that there was any resurrection." The Sadducees don't believe in, if the Pharisees were the conservatives, this is the ultra-liberals. They don't believe in anything except for the first five books of the Old Testament. All of the prophets, I mean, they respected them, but they didn't hold them as authoritative. The Psalms, none of that stuff. They only believed in the books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. From that, they didn't believe in, they were annihilationists, which means when you die, that's it, you're gone. And that's a popular view today. There's a lot of people who believe that. This life is all there is. You live like a hog, you die like a dog, and that's it. You're dead, you're gone. So get all you can get right now. Now, if you really believe that, if you believe that this life is all there is, there's no afterlife, you're going to live your life in such a way to maximize your pleasure and your comfort and stretch out your life as long as you can and do whatever you have to do to get yourself in a position of authority, comfort, riches, wealth, ease, you know. And so they were cozy, even though they were Jews, they were cozy with Caesar. They were sucking up to the authority of Rome so that they could have it easy for them. They didn't believe in an afterlife. They didn't believe in life after death. They didn't believe in the resurrection, what it says here. They deny there's any resurrection. That's funny. They're in a tough place. These people, you have to understand, the Pharisees came and then the Sadducees came, and they're working together on this. They hate each other. Those two groups can't stand each other. When Paul's brought on trial later on, he gets into a room before the Sanhedrin, basically the Supreme Court of Judaism, and they're going to cream him. And he looks around the room and he realizes half of them are Pharisees and half of them are Sadducees. And so he says, if I'm put on trial for being a Pharisee, I'm not afraid of it. And then, and the Pharisees are like, well, obviously he's innocent. And the Sadducees, well, he's guilty. And then they have this riot that breaks out because these people hate each other. But they unify around the fact they can't stand Jesus because he's bad for both their business. They're in a tough place. Back in just a few days before this, Jesus' friend Lazarus died, right? And he was dead, like 4 days dead. Jesus specifically delayed going until he was way dead and in the ground and stinky. And then he raises him from the dead. And everybody knew about it. If you are a person or you're a group that doesn't believe in life after death and you don't believe in the resurrection, and there's a guy that everybody knows was 4 days dead and is now alive and walking around having been resurrected, he is bad for business. And it even says in John chapter 12, many of the Jews knew that Jesus was there, and they didn't come for just Jesus' sake, but they wanted to see Lazarus, who had been raised from the dead. The chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus to death, because that by reason of him, many of the Jews went away and believed on Jesus. They were trying to kill Lazarus too, because he demonstrated that their belief system was false. That's not unusual. Any of you guys watch the Super Bowl last week? I mean, the Patriots weren't in there, so it was a subpar event, to be sure. And I didn't have any great love for either of the teams. I think, for me, probably the biggest thing, the difference between the two, was one of the quarterbacks was somewhat humble over the course of his life. The other one was not. And there's something glorious about watching someone who's been running his mouth about how awesome he is, you know, have the ball ripped out of his hands like a little baby, and that was nice. But if you've watched a Super Bowl before, what's the best part of the Super Bowl? And as a hint, it is not the halftime show, okay? Come on. They haven't made any good music in like 30 years. But anyway, it's the commercials. And they weren't that great this year, as far as commercials go. Any of you guys see the Doritos commercial this year at the Super Bowl? If you haven't seen it, okay? the Doritos commercial, it's a husband and wife, they're at the doctor's getting an ultrasound done. She's pregnant. She's laying on the table. The technician is working the thing. You got the screen. And the husband's sitting there eating a bag of Doritos. Like, he's, I got to be here, you know. And the doctor's, the nurse, the technician, whatever it is there, is rolling their eyes. And mother's like, I can't believe it. And so the guy's just sitting there eating Doritos, watching this thing. And he notices as he moves the Doritos, the baby on the screen in her belly makes a reach for the Doritos. So he starts moving it around, and you can see the hand inside going after the Doritos. And of course, you know, the wife is like, I can't believe my, oh, he's, you know, has to be or whatever. So he takes the chip and he moves it up to her head real quick, and the baby jumps up that way and nails her. And she's like, oh, you know. So she grabs the chip out of his hand and throws it this way. And then you see on the ultrasound, boom, the baby just jets out. Like, she gets, you know, like, ah, they're all screaming, you know. It was humorous, right? But it tweaked a certain segment of the population. This was what was tweeted by NARAL, which is the National Abortion Rights League. Hashtag not buying it. That Doritos and that Doritos ad using hashtag anti-choice tactic of humanizing fetuses and sexist tropes of dads as clueless and moms as uptight. They flipped out because how dare you show an ultrasound with something that looks like a baby who actually cares or has any desires. That is not a baby until the mom decides it is. And the fact that you're actually showing this thing moving in there and having a will and maybe having feelings, which anybody who's been pregnant knows, certain voices will make the child react certain way. You know, I used to, when we were pregnant with Abby, our oldest, we had a double bed. And I love my wife, but wow, you know, that was just the two of us in a double bed was, I mean, that was kind of nice when it was just the two of us. But when she's great with child, you know, and that thing's, and there were multiple times where I was woken up in the night because my daughter would put a foot through my wife's belly and kick me in the back in the middle of the night. I mean, you know, they're in there moving around, but it's the same thing that we see here. The fact that Lazarus' resurrection was shining light on the truth that there is a resurrection was bad for business. So they come to Jesus, and they're going to take their shot at trying to trip him up in his words. Only they do it a little differently. The first guys, they took a question that was a question of the day. As religious Jews, is it right for us to pay taxes or not? And they felt it was an unanswerable question. If we can get Jesus to take a side one way or the other, we've won. He didn't. Their problem was thinking it was binary and or. It wasn't. It was both and, okay? So now this is a different situation. This is not a question, a legitimate. This is a hypothetical question that was designed to be mocking of a particular religious belief because they didn't believe in it, and they were trying to show how stupid belief in resurrection was by asking a ridiculous question to Jesus. Now, they don't believe in a resurrection. They said, Master, Moses wrote unto us. And remember, they only took the first five books. And they're referencing something that was written in Deuteronomy chapter 25. It's called the Levirate marriage. It's not Levite. That's a descendant of Levi. And it's not Lever 2000. That's a soap. It's Levirate. He said, Master, Moses wrote unto us that if any man's brother die, having a wife, and he dies without children, that his brother should take his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. When they came into the land, remember, they came into the land of Israel, and it was broken up into sections. Every tribe got a section. Judah's here, Benjamin's here, you know, Simeon and all the different ones. The only ones who didn't were the Levites. They didn't get a piece of the land. In fact, when you look at the tithing and all of that, tithing in the Old Testament was so that the Levites who didn't get any land could get some produce and could get some animals that were raised in the land. That's what it was. You take a tenth of the produce, a tenth of the animals. It doesn't even say money. It said just produce and animals, and you give it to the Levites because they didn't get land. They were working in the temple serving me. But anyway, everybody got a piece of land. And when you had children, your kids would get a part of your property that you'd divide it up. The oldest would get a double portion, and then all the others would get a single portion. Well, what this says is, but if there was a section of land and a guy would marry a wife, and a lot of times, you know, you might marry outside of your tribe, you'd marry a wife and she'd come live with you on that property. If he didn't have any children to inherit his land, you can't have someone from outside of your tribe inhabiting that land or owning that land. So what you were supposed to do is your brother would marry your wife. And he'd have children with her. And the first child that he had would be as if it was his brother's child. And that child would get the inheritance. After that, any children would be yours and whatever. But it was called a Levirate marriage. And it was described in Deuteronomy 25, but it wasn't just to Judah. I mean, the Babylonians, the Sumerians, a bunch of different people groups did this. It actually happened biblically before the law. Back in Genesis 38, you have the account of Judah has some boys. It was like, you know, obviously Judah was like in the delivery room and froze on the spot. What are you going to name him? Okay. So he has but we're told is wicked and God kills him. Literally says God killed him. So he has another, and he was married and he didn't have any kids. And so he has a brother named Onan the barbarian. And so Onan marries his wife. And Onan's fine with the old marrying and sleeping with, but he didn't want to have any kids that would inherit the property, so he wouldn't get her pregnant. And that made God really angry. So Onan was dead. So they had one more son, brother, called Shelah. And Judah said, you know, I've married her to two of my kids and they're both dead. I got one left. Think we're going to wait a little while on this one. And he wouldn't do it. And you read the story, what happened. But it was all based around this idea of the Levirate marriage, okay? Genesis 38, it's a good passage. So their story that they bring to him, this hypothetical, is based around this idea. He says, there were therefore seven brothers, and the first took a wife, and he died without children. So the second took her to wife, and he died childless. And then the third took her. And in like manner, the seven also, and they left no children and died. And then finally, justly, the woman died. I mean, I'm thinking after three or four of my brothers have gone down, I'm going to take a trip, or I'm going to do something. There was actually a provision in the law, if you actually go back and you want to read it later, study on your own, Deuteronomy 25. If you didn't want to do it, if you didn't want to be the kinsman redeemer, you didn't want to marry this woman, you'd go to the city gate and she would take your shoe off and she'd spit in your face and you'd be henceforth known as the man whose shoe was loosed. It would be like the sign of shame. But you could get out of it if you thought she was like some black widow. There was a way. But anyway, you read the book of Ruth, the whole idea. Remember, there was somebody who was the right to be kinsman redeemer before Boaz and he had to go to him and negotiate in order to be able to marry her because of the property. Same idea. So anyway, all seven marry her. Nobody has any kids. They all die. And then here's their question. In the resurrection, whose wife is she? Because they all married her. And see, what they're thinking and laughing about is this idea that there is an afterlife when you have situations like this with marriage and death and remarried, and they're all going to be there in heaven arguing about who gets to be her wife or who has to be her husband, I guess. It depends, you know, how you look at it. And obviously, because that's a stupid, ridiculous thing, the idea of a resurrection is stupid and ridiculous. That's the point. Jesus answers them. Now, Matthew adds this little bit in. Jesus answered and he says, you do err because you don't know the scriptures and you don't know the power of God. And truthfully, people who completely discount the word of God err in two levels. They don't understand who God is and they don't understand his word. Jesus answering said unto them, the children of this world marry and are given, or literally the children of this age, this age we live in, they marry and they're given in marriage. But they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that age or that world and the resurrection from the dead, they don't marry and they're not given in marriage. For some of you, that may really be a bummer. For others, it may be a great relief. He says, neither can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels in that they don't die, the same as the angels don't, and they're the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. He says, you're blowing it because you don't understand. You're trying to govern what happens then in a different place, in a different time, a different economy, a different everything, and you're judging it by what you see now. It's ridiculous. That's not how it works. Now, it's interesting, again, you look at different belief. Any of you guys ever grow up, were you Mormon or grow up in a Mormon background? I used to work for a guy who was a Mormon. And I remember going to his house, and they had this, all the way up the stairs, I thought it was cool. They had all of these family photos, like all these different, all up the stairway. You could see all these different pictures of not just their family, but like generations back and everything. But then they had this thing in the middle of it, and it said, family is forever. Because they believe that. Part of the Mormon church, you get married, and then you get sealed in the Mormon temple. You have this special ceremony, and then you two are husband and wife forever. And they believe, you know, after you die, you get to be like the god of your own planet and fill it with spirit babies. I mean, that's their belief system. But biblically, sorry, that you're not married. It's different in the resurrection. I really like that it says there won't be dying anymore. I don't want to die. I guess I don't mind it. Like Woody Allen, I don't mind death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. You know, I mean, it is kind of freaky because I've never been through it. I will be glad when there's no more separation. That's the worst part of death, is the person that you love and you've spent time with and you don't get to see them and talk to them anymore. And, you know, things ease over time and it becomes easier, but I am very much looking to that. Forward to the, you know, being able to see my father again and my grandmother again and different people, and not just as some, you know, happy thought or rainbow or wispy thing that we float through each other. We'll actually be able to hug, and it'll be cool. But then he goes on, because see, there'd been this argument, because they don't believe in the afterlife or the resurrection or any of those things, because they couldn't find any mention of it in the first five books. The first five books don't talk explicitly about heaven and various other things. And so, and there was this debate going between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees believed in resurrection. They believe in the afterlife. They believe in all of this. But they couldn't convince them because they would only listen to the first five books. And they had this argument that was running. And this is what Jesus says. And he said, but your problem is you don't know the scriptures and you don't know the power of God. He said, but that the dead are raised, even Moses, who you listen to, right? Moses books. He showed at the burning bush when he called the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him. You remember when Moses was called by God, he sees this bush burning in the wilderness, but it's not being consumed. He's out tending sheep. He goes up to it, and he hears a voice out of there, tells him to take off his shoes. He's standing on holy ground, and he asks him who he am, and he says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. I am. Jacob, Isaac, and Abraham had died long before this event happened. Jesus' point he's making here is God out of the burning bush didn't say, I was the God of Abraham, I was the God of Isaac. He said, I am, because they're still alive. They're just not here. And so he makes the point that because God used that tense, it means that those people still exist. There is life after death. Now, the scribes, the people who are Pharisees, they think it's awesome. Certain of the scribes answered and said, Master, you've said well. And after that, they dared not ask him any more questions at all. A couple interesting things out of that. First of all, Jesus' argument in that particular section, where he refutes the belief system of the Sadducees, which the Pharisees have never been able to done, was based upon what? The difference between the word am and the difference between was. Jesus' whole argument is based on the tense of one word from the Old Testament. He takes the scriptures very literally. Certainly, when the scriptures are intending to be taken figuratively, take them figuratively. There are times when they obviously are. However, he also takes them very literally at times, and he bases his whole case on just that one verb. More importantly, verse 40, after that, they dared not ask him any questions at all. Does that mean we should never question God? We shouldn't question him at all? I hope not. I think you should, to be honest with you. Well, you do, right? Stuff happens. Our questions typically are the W's. Why? You know, that's why. Why? Why am I going through this? Why am I not going through this? This is not God saying, don't you dare ask me or I'll just confound you. He's not that way. I think the question always comes back, and I read a quote, I don't have it in front of me, by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who, you know, was a Christian who ended up dying in the concentration camps. Great theologian, German theologian. You know, he says, the questions that all start with how or why or what, those are more questions that lack faith. The question of faith starts with who. Because you have to understand, these people are coming to God not to hear an answer. They're coming to try to trip him up. But we're not going for that purpose. If you're a Christian, if you're a follower of Christ, that's not why you question. A lot of times we question, why, God? Why do I have to go through this? Why am I dealing with this? Why is it like this? Lord, what is your plan? I don't get it. Lord, how can this possibly be for good? You say all things work together for good, but how can this in my life or this happening to this person, how can that be good? What is the plan? Why are you doing this? It's disingenuous to pretend you never have those questions. He's reasonable. What does he say? Come, let us reason together. It's okay to go to God. He knows your thoughts. You're not hiding it. I mean, he always says, I know, knowing their thoughts, perceiving their craftiness or what. He knows their thoughts. So you're just lying to yourself if you pretend that, oh, I always believe and I never question. I think the key is to start, though, with who. Understand who it is that we're asking. We're asking the one who in a couple days from this time is going to stretch out his hands and take nails. He's going to be spit in the face. He's going to have his beard ripped out. He's going to have his back shredded, and he's going to die because he loves us. I'd love to tell you that if you become a Christian, you'll get wonderful, happy answers, and you'll understand all mysteries. I don't. Maybe you do. I don't. If you do, talk to me afterwards because I have a few to ask you. But I'm still hanging on to who he is. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you are merciful, that you are long-suffering, that you are good. Lord, forgive me for doubting. Forgive me for being afraid. Forgive me for the times when I try to take things into my own hands. Lord, forgive me especially for the times when I try to trip you up in your words to get out of something you've said that I don't like. Lord, I pray you would give us the strength and the faith to trust you. Lord, help us to trust even when we don't see. And Lord, please come quickly so that we can see. May it be soon, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.